Hey, this is Nick Gelso, co-owner and founder of CLNS Radio. Today's podcast is brought to you by Lynda.com. Lynda.com is the home of expert video tutorials. Because you're such a loyal listener of CLNS Radio, and it's 2015, you want to kick the new year off in style, claim your free trial today from CLNS by going to Lynda.com/CLNS. That's LYNDA.com/CLNS. Now on to your regularly scheduled program.
Welcome to the Boston Celtics postgame show on CLNSradio.com.
Off the turnover, Rondo reverse, bites it in.
Fans, this is your destination for interactive Celtics coverage all season long.
Kelly still has time, takes it.
So what are you waiting for? We want to hear from you. Dial in at 347-215-7771.
Green out of the corner. Got another one.
Now let's get it started.
Welcome to the Celtics postgame show. I'm your host, Bobby Kravitsky, alongside Calvin Chamberlain once again. Celtics postgame show is brought to you by Lynda.com. New skills, improved skills, now designed to photography. You name it, Lynda.com has it. Be sure to check it out. And if you want to call in to talk about the Celtics' 100-87 victory over the Indiana Pacers, do so by dialing 347-215-7771. Again, that number is 347-215-7771. And what a game this was. The Celtics needed it, and they got it. First, they took care of business in Charlotte on the second night of a back-to-back, which for whatever reason, the Seas are excellent at doing this year. Then they come home, take care of the Pacers, really in control for the majority of this game. And the key, folks, was defense. That's what sparked their runs in the first half, including to end both of the opening quarters. That's what allowed them to take a double-digit lead in the second half and to hold serve when the Pacers came charging back like you knew they would. We've seen this too many times out of the Celtics for that not to be the case, that this game wouldn't get interesting at one point late. And of course, that is how things happened before ultimately Boston was able to hold off the run. And then Indiana, for whatever reason, they were disinterested when the Celtics beat them in Indiana. And that was the case for much of tonight. Again, they checked out once Boston held off their second half surge. Very impressive game. Evan Turner, another triple-double. He was the one facilitating Boston's offense. The Celtics had 29 assists on 39 field goals, an excellent number. And when you don't really have a primary scorer, that's a key for your offense. Boston got it done tonight, largely as a result of Evan Turner being able to facilitate and distribute. He had another triple-double tonight, as I mentioned. His numbers overall, a stat line of 13 points, 12 dimes, 11 rebounds. He also did an excellent job of protecting the basketball, only turning it over one time. He was huge for Boston, even in the first half. And then also Kelly Olynyk, he's another one of the main stories from tonight's game. Let me tell you something, Shavlik Randolph elbowing him before the game, that's the biggest contribution Randolph has made and will make all season. So Celtics finally get something out of the former Duke Blue Devil. Olynyk, who he seemed to knock some aggression into, finishes with 19 points, 7 of 10 from the field, 3 of 4 from beyond the arc. He's had people question his toughness in the past. He answered the bell tonight after getting his bell rung by Randolph before the game even started. Didn't know if he was going to play, but he was aggressive from the moment his number was called and he came off the bench. It was refreshing to see. And I'll tell you, folks, if you've listened to me on this show, I think I've established the fact that I'm not exactly Tommy Heinsohn. You know, I'm not that degree of a homer or anything, but Kelly Olynyk had a specific play. I made sure to make a mental note of this. It was with just under 9.5 minutes to play in the game. It really was shades of a young Dirk Nowitzki. He's never going to live up to that bill or anything of the nature, but the play was just so reminiscent of Nowitzki's style and how the German seven-footer likes to play. What he did, I'll take you through it, was he catches the ball at the three-point line. And there's so many times where even when he has that shot, He'll do that ridiculous up fake that no one falls for, and it really doesn't set him or his teammates up to accomplish anything. This time, however, rather than the up fake, he caught it and just went right by a defender on a bad closeout, stops on a dime when he gets about 5 feet from the basket, gives the up fake, gets his defender to go by, goes off the wrong foot, shades of that unorthodox Nowitzki style, and swishes home the jumper showing soft touch. I'll tell you, if you watch the play, you know what I'm talking about. And hearing it, I hope it gave you the mental image, because it really was something that you could put on a split screen next to Dirk Nowitzki and see the similarities. It was awesome to see from Kelly Olynyk, who had a big game tonight. Again, 19 points, doing it from both inside and outside. And Tyler Zeller, I know he didn't have the greatest game overall, was much quieter in the second half when we scored 2 points. But in the first and second quarters, he took Roy Hibbert's lunch money. 17 points, gave the big fella from Georgetown the business. It was exciting to see. If you want to talk about Olynyk's black eye and the game he had, if you want to talk about Tyler Zeller balling out in the first half, do so by calling on 347-215-7771. Again, that's 347-215-7771. Celtics win it 100-87. And I'll tell you another huge factor. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but when the Celtics get to the line frequently, they win games. And I'm willing to bet they won a hell of a lot more of them than they've lost. Tonight, they go to line 18 times, convert 16 of those attempts. It's, as always, it was a huge factor in why they won this game. Looking around the box score at some other stats that are worthy of mentioning, how about Jonas Jerebko? 4 offensive rebounds, helping contribute to the Celtics getting 16 second chance points. You think that's important in a game they win by 13? Yeah, it was. You're right. They also had 42 paints in the point total. Huge game from the Celtics, who were aggressive against the Pacers defense that, even though it doesn't live up to the billing of, you know, even last year when they were championship contender and Paul George was there on the perimeter, they still have Roy Hibbert. They've still got David West. George Hill is back. Hill had a terrific game, 16 points, 6 of 9 from the field, and also had 6 times, 6 rebounds in 36 minutes. But nonetheless, Boston was able to get into the paint and make the Pacers pay, which was really nice to see from a team that has such a penchant for shooting threes. Boston didn't exactly excel from beyond the arc tonight. Instead, they shot just a mere 22% from three-point range, ugly 6 of 27. But they jacked up 86 shots total, so they more than made up for it by balancing it out and being able to score in the paint. Sometimes from Boston, you'll either get one or the other. Tonight, I know they didn't have it going from three-point range, but there was such a balance in shot selection. If anything, it leaned more towards going to the basket. It was nice to see. I like when Boston plays that inside-out brand of basketball. Really made a difference tonight. Just want to remind you that the Celtics post-game show is brought to you by CLNS Radio. Be sure to check out CLNS.com for the best in audio and written content. And now we go to the man of the hour, Calvin Chamberlain, to discuss the Celtics 100-87 win. Calvin, how's it going? What are your overall thoughts on this game?
Well, it was a big win tonight. I don't know if you were made aware of this or not, but I watched the game normally on League Pass, and because it was NBA TV, it was blacked out for me. Yeah, I didn't manage to listen to it on the radio, so I didn't really pick up all the subtle nuances that I'm sure you picked up. But certainly, it was a huge win for them in terms of playoff positioning. Obviously, it pushes Indiana down now to, you know, the 11th seed, sort of solidifies a little bit their position in that number 8 spot.
Calvin, that is dedication to check the game on the radio with NBA TV not allowing you to watch the game. Did you have Grandy and Max on the call?
I did. Something was going on with their audio, so I actually switched over to the Pacers audio. I'm not sure who they were, but they were a little bland.
That's unfortunate. Now let me ask you, what's going on with this Pacers team that even when the Celtics last played them in Indiana, The Celtics beat them, and Indiana didn't look all that engaged in the contest, and that was the case for much of tonight's game. What's going on with this Pacers team?
Well, I think that when they went on their little run, you know, a lot of that had to do with the schedule and what was going on with them. They're not a particularly talented team. I kind of feel similarly the way we've been talking about the Celtics. I kind of feel similarly about the Pacers. I feel like they're extremely under-talented, and they're just really well coached. I mean, without Paul George out there, I really don't, especially you look at their backcourt, you know, they're playing George Hill, C.J. Miles, Rodney Stuckey, their primary rotation. That's 25th to 30th in the NBA in terms of talent. 25th is probably a little optimistic. Roy Hibbert, although, you know, an excellent defensive player, offensively, he's almost non-existent at times. And as much as I love David West, he's hit the wall a little bit at this point in his career. So what does Indiana really have minus George that scares anybody?
Yeah, I would certainly say nothing, even with the boost that George Hill has provided them since coming back. I mentioned earlier in the program he had 21 points tonight to go along with 6 dimes and 6 rebounds. But I want to ask you about Roy Hibbert, because we all know he's a terrific defender, and I don't know how much you were able to see or even hear about this in the first half, but Tyler Zeller in the first 2 quarters took Hibbert's lunch money, 17 points. He dominated the big man from Georgetown.
Yeah, I noticed that in the first half that he did, and he went 8 for 9 for the game. I think first half he was, what, 7 for 8. I'd like to know why they went away from him. Now, how many of those points do you think were scored at Hibbert directly? It's funny that, you know, Zeller's got long arms. I don't know if a lot of that was pick and roll and getting past him, or was he actually managing to go over Hibbert?
Well, a lot of it had to do with getting the big fella to move, not just laterally, but also getting him to backpedal, which made it easier for, I know Zeller has long arms too, but it made it easier to get his shot off over the big 7-footer. So a lot of it had to do not Zeller necessarily catching it with his back to the basket as much as it was pick and rolls and things of that nature.
Yeah, that's what I figured. I mean, it's hard to go directly at a guy like Roy Hibbert, and that's where you credit Stevens for a good game plan. Tyler Zeller, I've always thought, excels in pick and roll situations, and I always like it when they focus him in the offense for that reason. Rather than try to post him up, which is, you know, a situation where I don't think is very effective, particularly against a guy like Hibbert.
Calvin, I'm not sure if you're aware of this or not. This might just be the sports nerd in me coming out, but there was a Pro Bowl defensive tackle, John Henderson, and to get himself psyched up for games, he would have the trainer smack him across the face a couple times so he could get that initial contact out of the way, and it would give him an adrenaline rush, allow him to play better. Kelly Olynyk takes an elbow to the eye from Chavlik Randolph. Looks like he can barely see out of that eye. Comes out and has 19 points, 7 to 10 from the field, 3 of 4 from beyond the arc. Had an extremely aggressive game. He was balling tonight.
Yeah, I saw the pictures on the internet. His eye was looking pretty rough. There was pretty funny sort of memes going around about how nobody should mess with Chavlik Randolph. I enjoyed that. But, it looks like he came out there aggressive, and that's good. I'm sure he had the way his eye looked, it looked like he'd have a hard time seeing, or at least you'd think that it would affect your depth perception, but not tonight. He was hitting those long-range shots.
Yeah, I guess it was a similar effect to, you know, where you look under a microscope, you need one eye. I guess this made him a little more precise. Olynyk, huge game, as I said, 19 points, doing it inside and outside. Nice to see. And Evan Turner, another triple-double, thriving in that role as a point forward. He had 9 dimes in the first half, followed that up with 13 points, 12 assists on the night, 11 rebounds. Calvin, he also did a great job protecting the ball, just 1 turnover.
Yeah, no, really impressive night for him. I guess, you know, when you play a team like Indiana, who, you know, doesn't really put pressure on you, a lot of ball pressure on you with their guards, you'll see a guy like Evan Turner, especially, you know, with his size, tonight he took advantage of it. And it's good to see the playmaking Evan Turner that we saw earlier in the season. I feel like since the trade for Thomas and, you know, since some of the roster changes, he sort of shied away from being the offensive playmaker. But I think that the way he's played this year, he's shown that he can do it. And because his team doesn't have a traditional point guard, it's nice to see him take up that role.
Yeah, it really has been. It also helps to go up against the likes of C.J. Miles. You know, that'll make you look good. But just his ability to run the offense, to get guys involved. He had a couple beautiful give and goes, including a few with Olynyk, some with Tyler Zeller. Terrific job running this offense. And including Calvin, the Celtics had 29 assists on 39 field goals. And if Turner was on the bench and the offense was starting to get dry and they were either looking to make the hero pass, which was resulting in turnovers, or go one-on-one and guys were looking to do it themselves, Stevens had no problem going right back to Turner on short rest. And immediately he came in and calmed down the offense and got the Celtics into their sets and running their stuff.
Definitely. And excuse me. I was impressed by his performance tonight again. You know, he didn't shoot very well, and that's too bad. But considering everything else he did on the floor, you can't really knock him too much for that.
No, certainly not. I also thought, Calvin, we talked about this after Monday's game, that a key for Boston, like any team really, but especially I'm going to say the Celtics because they lack that primary scorer, is getting to the foul line. And you can see what a difference it makes in games where they're successful. And tonight they're able to get to the stripe 18 times, convert on 16 attempts. This is still getting a few less opportunities from Isaiah Thomas, who looks like he's getting better, but not 100% yet. So this was important, and it was impressive, especially against an Indiana team that's known for protecting the rim. To be able to go into the paint and draw fouls was huge for the Celtics tonight.
Definitely. I hate to keep reiterating the fact that I didn't see the game, so it makes it difficult for me to say, but the Celtics are a team that doesn't get a lot of free throw attempts compared to league average. I think 18 might be right around average for them. I'd have to look that up. But certainly hitting 16 of 18 is something, you know, better than they normally do. I don't know, you're saying a lot of that had to do with them getting inside. It sounds like they did get to Hibbert defensively. Was he not, did he not look like, you know, the Hibbert that we've grown to know? Or
yeah, he was just not the same Roy Hibbert that you come to expect tonight. For whatever reason, Indiana as a whole just didn't seem overly engaged in this game.
Yeah, you would think with a trip to the playoffs potentially on the line, that this would be the kind of game that they'd want to, you know, be most engaged in. But fortunately for the Celtics, that was not the case.
Fortunately. And if you want to talk about that or any other matter surrounding this game, do so by dialing 347-215-7771. Again, that's 347-215-7771. Celtics postgame show. The C's are now just a half a game behind Brooklyn for that eighth spot. Calvin, the team has games coming up against the likes of Milwaukee, Toronto, the Pistons, and the Cavs. What do you think this team's playoff prospects are? It's not the easiest schedule to close out the season.
No, I'd like to look at the schedules of the other teams coming up to as a comparison. I think that, you know, obviously the Cavs at that point might have that second spot locked up, so maybe they have a chance in that game if they sit some people. But the rest of those games, you know, the Pistons are not playing for anything at this point. Who are the other teams? I'm sorry.
Toronto and Milwaukee.
Yeah, Toronto and Milwaukee. Milwaukee is sort of locked in their playoff position, so, and they haven't been playing that well at this point in the season. That game's at Boston. I would expect them to be the favorite and win that game. That's the kind of game you need to win if you want to make the playoffs. Toronto's also been struggling, but that is a road game. So I think, you know, going 1-for-2 in those games, maybe losing the Cleveland game if they're at full strength, but hopefully not. And then winning the other game at Detroit.
That would be huge for the Celtics if they can just, you know, especially like you said, if Cleveland chooses to rest guys, most notably LeBron James and Kyrie Irving, then certainly opens the doors for Boston to earn a victory there. Detroit, nothing to play for, like you said. And we'll see what happens against Milwaukee, who may be content to just ride out the rest of the season. And Toronto, team that's given them problems these last two seasons, we'll see if they can overcome the wraps. Going to be interesting. Again, just a quick reminder, the number is 347-215-7771. We're going to go to the phone lines right now. We've got the one, the only, Matt Rury, who wants to talk about the big man from Georgetown, Roy Hibbert.
Hey, gentlemen. I figured I'd bail Calvin out a little bit here since he was screwed over by NBA TV. But I just heard you guys talking about Roy Hibbert, and it sort of made me think about this thing that I heard in passing. I think it was on the post-game show. I was in the other room, and I sort of heard, I believe, Kyle Draper on TV just sort of talking about what the problem was with Hibbert tonight. And he sort of mentioned that Tyler Zeller has owned Roy Hibbert in the past few games. And I wanted to call into this show and say that that's not exactly true, because I actually went back and basketballreference.com actually has a nice feature where you can look up player versus player and see what they've done against each other over the past few games. So Zeller did have a nice game on March 14th against Roy Hibbert. He did pretty much own him in that game. He was 8 of 10 with 7 rebounds. Hibbert was just 2 of 6 with 7 rebounds as well. But going back further than that, Roy Hibbert has just dominated Tyler Zeller to no end. Back on January 9th, he took 19 shots in a game that Indiana ended up winning. And Zeller was pretty much a no-show in that game, 7 points, 5 rebounds. Before that, Hibbert outscored him 22-6. He took 16 shots in that game. So I just wanted to, without really calling too much attention to it, just point out that it's not a Zeller thing. And I think that what you said, Bobby, for whatever reason, Indiana just wasn't into it tonight.
Well, let me ask you, you bring up those numbers from, you know, the history of this one-on-one matchup. Isn't that kind of what you would expect between Tyler Zeller going up against Roy Hibbert?
Yeah, I would definitely expect that. I mean, Hibbert's kind of a beast of a player. I'll let Calvin speak to that as well.
Yeah, it's funny because Hibbert's, you know, he's a lot bigger and he's a lot stronger than Tyler Zeller, but he often doesn't look for his offense. So when Rui says he took 19 shots against Tyler Zeller another time, it's surprising. I feel like Roy Hibbert is a lot better offensive player than he, you know, gets an opportunity to prove. Or it seems like they don't really run sets for him in the offense, but he's so big, and when he gets decent position, he's hard to stop. But I don't know, some part of me feels like his offensive laziness, he just doesn't want to get that position often enough. And part of me feels like they just don't make him a focus in the offense when he should be more of a focus in the offense.
Yeah, I don't know. Bobby, you tell me, but I think that he just sort of eats matchups alive, and he's one of those typical NBA centers that if he finds a guy that's sort of weaker than him or not as good of a center, he's going to attack that player. But otherwise, then he sort of goes off into the background of the Pacer offense. And for whatever reason, for the past two games, Tyler Zeller has gotten the upper hand on him.
Yeah, and it's also, like Calvin said, a product of Indiana's offense has a tendency to go away from him or even ignore him for long stretches. So when he gets a matchup like Tyler Zeller, they look at that and think, here's an opportunity to make an emphasis on getting him the ball down low, getting him touches, keeping him involved in the offense. Because we saw last year in the playoffs, and we've seen it time and time again with Indiana, that when Hibbert's involved in the offense, as good a defender as he is, regardless, he's more engaged at the defensive end when that happens, which is only natural, and it makes Indiana a better team. Plus, it makes them more dynamic offensively to have that presence on the block.
All right, guys. Yeah, I mean, that's all I really had for you. I just heard you talking about Hibbert, and that's it. If I hear anything else that I want to tune in on or pipe in on, I'll call you back.
Always good to hear from you, Rury.
Have a good night, gentlemen. Maybe I'll talk to you in a little bit.
Night, buddy.
All right, Calvin. So as we get back, what's up?
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that as we get back to the show here, looking at the call screen, we're going to have Jared Weiss calling from the locker room in just a couple minutes. Be interesting to hear what he has to say and the sound he gathered from both the Celtics and Pacers after this game. It'd be interesting to hear, you know, Indiana's take on this game, and maybe they were faced with some questions about their lack of effort for the full 48 minutes tonight. Anything you particularly interested in hearing from Jared on this game?
I would like to know, you know, again, I'd like to know a little bit more about Evan Turner's game and, you know, who is the recipient of the majority of his passes. Did he just have the, was it, you know, a lot of pick and roll stuff, or were they running the offense through him, or, you know, how much of that was fast break? Give me a little more insight into Evan Turner's game.
Yeah, not that much of it was off the fast break. I know the Celtics had 19 fast break points, but, you know, as far as Turner's distribution, it was largely off of just making him the focal point of the offense, letting him handle the ball up top or running side pick and rolls with him. And, you know, a couple times there were some nice give and goes. As for the primary beneficiaries, it was easily Zeller and Olynyk. I don't have on my screen right here, you know, how many baskets came from Turner feeds for each one of them or for the rest of the team, but those were clearly watching the game, the two players who benefited the most from Turner's dimes.
So it was a lot of drive and kick out to the three, basically.
Yeah, a lot of that. Also a good job of him to, you know, when he was running the offense from above the break, a good job of getting into the paint and finding the open teammate, which tended to be pulling Roy Hibbert out towards Turner and dropping it down for Zeller. And then, like you said, when he was kicking out, it was usually Olynyk.
All right, well, I think that, you know, that's the advantage of having a guy who's 7 feet tall who can hit a three-pointer. It, like Kelly Olynyk, it's hard to guard a guy out there. Who do they have on in the majority of the game? Which I'm assuming they didn't have West, you know, pulling out that far out to the three-point line. So I'm guessing he was probably guarded. And I'm certainly not Hibbert. So I'm guessing he was probably guarded by a lot of smaller guys for the most part. And that's the advantage, you know, when you play a traditional team and you have a stretch four or even a stretch five, if you want to call him that, like Olynyk.
Yeah, it's huge to have that versatile weapon there who can pose a mismatch to a team's front court. Also, Calvin, a play that stuck out with me with Olynyk. I feel the need to preface this by saying that you know me. We've done a couple shows together that I'm not exactly Tommy Heinsohn on the homer scale, but Olynyk had a play tonight with just under 9:30 left in the game. I hope I can give you the proper visual image here where he caught the ball at the three-point line, and instead of doing that useless pump fake that he does 95% of the time, he caught it, took advantage of a bad closeout, and just blew right by his defender without any hesitation, then stopped on a dime about 5 feet from the basket, got his defender to go by him with a pump fake, went off the wrong foot, unorthodox, shades of Dirk Nowitzki, and showed deft touch to knock down the shot.
That doesn't sound like it doesn't sound too homerish to me. I mean, Kelly Olynyk, I think at times shows a deceptive level of speed that you wouldn't expect from him, and I think that's how he manages to blow by guys in that situation. You know, most of the time he doesn't show that speed, and I think guys aren't expecting it. And every once in a while, yeah, he gets a play, you know, off the dribble where he scores, and you don't expect him to do it.
Yeah, and it was certainly refreshing to see. Like I said, you know, an elbow to the eye might be a little too much to do night in and night out, but they might have to keep finding a way to just, you know, maybe a couple slaps to the face for Olynyk, not too hard, but they've got to find a way to keep his adrenaline rush going before games, because this was arguably his best game of the season.
Yeah, I think that didn't he have a game earlier in the season where he scored like 28? Maybe I'm remembering incorrectly, but definitely his best game in a while, certainly his best game since he's come back from his injury. So, you know, people were wondering a little bit about that and, you know, whether or not he was fully recovered or whether or not he's, you know, not even fully recovered physically, but fully recovered psychologically. But he seems to be back at this point, and that's good to see. Now, if we can only say the same about Isaiah Thomas, and we're in good shape.
Yeah, and that the 28-point performance, it might have even been a couple points more than that, but it came against Philadelphia, so especially because it was earlier in the season, you almost have to discount it to a degree. Nonetheless, though, and very impressive from Olynyk. And I'll tell you, another one of the most important parts to this game, I know we've been talking a lot about the offensive side of the ball, but the Celtics' defense is what sparked their runs, especially the stretches they had in the first half that allowed them to extend the lead and push it into double digits. And, of course, when holding off that second-half surge by the Pacers.
Yeah, definitely. They went on a little run in that third quarter. It sounded like it was being driven by Hibbert and Hill. And, you know, they once again, the Celtics managed to persevere in that situation. I feel like they're kind of immune to being phased by, you know, runs by the other team at this point.
Do you think that the Celtics have, as a result of being in so many close games this season, have become mentally tougher over the course of the year, and as a result, are a little bit more confident and more successful in these late game situations or when these teams now go on a run against them?
Yeah, I definitely think they're more confident. I definitely think that it's just more familiar to them. They've gotten the reps. Like you said, there are a lot of young players on this team. You know, there were issues about whose team it was and how, you know, what plays they were going to run earlier. And now it seems like they know exactly what they're going to do. And that really makes a big difference.
And talk to me also while we're on the subject, something that fortunately for Boston didn't come up tonight because they were able to hold serve when the Pacers made the run. But Brad Stevens' late game execution and his play calling is something that was questioned a lot at the beginning of the season. I remember doing the postgame show after they lost at home to the Cavaliers, where they blew a big lead in the fourth quarter and at the end of the game didn't even get a shot off. Whereas now, in late games, you know, you just go on social media, especially Twitter, and you see people praising the job he's doing at the end of games.
Yeah, I've talked my head off about his improvement. Like from earlier in the season, I felt like the Celtics just couldn't win a close game. Now it feels like they can't lose a close game. I mean, the turnaround in how this team is playing in those situations, it's phenomenal. I mean, he's always done a good job of trying plays up out of timeouts, but I think that you know, in the past in late game situations, he wouldn't always necessarily make the right decision. But now, you know, there's nothing to say as far as that goes.
Another very exciting part of Brad Stevens' growth. Of course, he's a huge part in the Celtics' rebuilding process as the head coach and this team trying to work its way back into title contention. Only a year or two, so I know people are excited with the prospect of potentially making the playoffs, but it's also important to remain patient. And once again, we go back to the phone lines. If you want to make your voice heard, dial 347-215-7771. But I'm here to tell you, you will not have priority over the man we're about to hear from next. We've got, from the Boston Garden, Jared Weiss on the phone. Jared, how's it going?
Great segue, man. It's going pretty well.
That's good to hear, Jared. Now, let me ask you, what was the overall theme that you picked up on talking to these guys after the game?
Well, some people were mentioning this thing that happened with Kelly Olynyk. I don't know if you've heard, but actually just tweeted out a photo. I got a close-up photo of Kelly's grill. It did not look too good for him tonight. I think everybody is kind of shocked by the fact that he played and that he actually scored. It was the team-high score. I'm telling you, unless you see his eye up close, you really can't appreciate how bad it is. I mean, it's like swelling up. It looks like a golf ball. It's the size of a golf ball. It's the best way to describe it.
It looks pretty bad on TV, so that is saying something right there.
Yeah, no, I was standing next to him looking at it, and then I saw it on TV almost like a minute after that, and I was like, wow, the camera doesn't quite even show how bad it is.
Jared, do you think that all his one-eyed shot practicing is paying off tonight? Or
has he been shooting with one eye this whole season? Is that why he's been shooting like 39% most of the year? I mean, I was standing on the bench watching him warming up pregame, and at first, when he was first, his very first shots that he took after the injury, he was shooting from the corner, and his depth reception, it's, you know, depth reception is really difficult from the corner. And it, he was like front rimming, back rimming. It's like he clearly had no idea like what the range was. And then he started to get a feel for it. He stopped pulling the ball to the, or pushing the ball to the right. He got his feel for the depth perception. Once he worked his way up to the elbows in his pregame shoot around, he was starting to nail them pretty consistently. He was, I mean, he was, for what it's worth, he was shooting with Phil Pressey, and he was making more than Phil Pressey. But I'm not really sure Phil Pressey could beat anybody with one eye or even no eyes in a shooting contest.
Well, it sounds to me like the Celtics are going to have to find a way, maybe just a couple slaps across the face in the pregame to keep these adrenaline rushes going for Olynyk prior to tip-off, because this was one of his best games of the season. Like you said, 75% from beyond the arc, 7 of 10 from the field. Another key member was obviously Evan Turner, who's getting a lot of deserved attention for tonight's performance, which was another triple-double, 13 points, 12 dimes, 11 rebounds. What, in your opinion, was the key to that? Was it just a result of being, you know, one of the primary facilitators, or was there something more to Turner's success tonight?
Well, Stevens talked about how Turner, in that when he's with the second unit a lot of the time, he gets to be primary ball handler. And even with the first unit, he gets to still be primary ball handler. But it works for him. It's really, Stevens said it was the first time in his career, pretty much, that he's got extensive run as a primary ball handler. When he was really like the de facto point guard, he was kind of struggling with it because there was a lot of pressure on him to kind of be the initiator of the entire offense. But as he's kind of playing on, I'd say, as a pseudo wing right now. And when he's going up, like tonight, he had a matchup against Solomon Hill a lot of the time. And then he kind of had, I mean, there was kind of a mixed matchup on him. But when he was going up against Solomon Hill, or whether it was George Hill or CJ Miles or even David West, He has a pretty good mismatch there. And by putting him at the three, he's played a lot better this year when he gets to be next to Bradley and Smart and Thomas, because they take the primary pressure off of him to handle the rock. He gets a more favorable matchup for him to be a ball handler and to have a little bit of an advantage quickness-wise, because strength isn't really going to be his advantage as much as quickness. And now that he's playing the three, it's working pretty well for him. Tonight was just one of those nights where he kind of had it clicking. And frankly, Indiana didn't really impress besides maybe the fourth quarter. They started to get together a little bit there, but Indiana was kind of flat the entire game.
Jared, I know that, you know, positions have kind of been erased in the new NBA, but I'm fascinated by the idea that you see Turner as the three, because I kind of, you know, watching the team, I kind of feel like Marcus Smart plays more of a three slasher type role, and Turner handles a little more. But defensively, do you think that he's being guarded more by the bigger guys, and Smart's being guarded more by the two guards? I mean, that's really what it comes down to, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like the definition of position for perimeter players nowadays is just who's covering you, really, and then how much of a primary ball handling responsibility do you have? So Turner is a point forward, which there's been a good amount of point forwards over the years. You could put T-Mac and LeBron at the top end of the spectrum, maybe Hito Turkoglu in the lower end of the example spectrum there. He's somewhere below Hito Turkoglu on that spectrum even. But you know, he runs point a lot of the time. I still will consider him a forward. I still see him as a forward rather than a point guard. And Smart plays off the ball a lot. So it's you know, the concept of, you know, they play with two main ball handlers usually, so that Turner, who is running point as a point forward, doesn't necessarily have to be the only ball handler and have primary ball handling responsibilities. So he's not really going to be the guy trying to break a press. He's not going to be the guy usually starting the play. Usually it's someone else who's going to bring the ball up. He'll run a curl off of a down screen to get the ball, and then he can make a pick and roll action happen, or he can find somebody else flaring from the corner. That's where Turner really thrives, because that gives him a little bit more room creatively and maybe gives him a little bit of a head start, because he's not really one with an amazing first step. So him having a head start usually helps a lot.
Switching sides now to the defensive side of the ball, Calvin and I, shortly before you came on, were talking about how that was the key, especially in the first half, to starting the runs the Celtics made, and then in the second half being able to hold off that Pacers surge. Was that talked about post-game, or, you know, were there more other topics that were the points of emphasis?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't call that a point of emphasis, but, I mean, the big thing was just Tyler Zeller was just scoring all over the place. You know, he had, I think it was 8-9 at one point after a CJ Miles jumper. And then the Celtics went on a good run there. They finished the quarter up 22-16 in the first. And Zeller, I think he had eight points, I want to say, after that. You know, he was really, I'm sorry, 9 points actually after that point. So Zeller really went on a roll, and that was really great for them. They kind of, I mean, it was just one of those games where I really think the big thing I saw was just that Indiana didn't look at all competitive. Like in the second quarter, Indiana never really got close. Third quarter, they didn't really do much to really get themselves in there in the third quarter. It was just one of those games where Indiana just never really showed up to play.
And Jared, I want to ask you about that. Is that simply, you know, we don't have Paul George. We're not the same team we were a year ago.
No. I mean, come on. They've been without Paul George all year, right? This isn't anything new. They went on a huge run right after the All-Star break, and they looked like a sure thing to be in the playoffs right after the All-Star break. I mean, they got good production out of their point guards and Hill and Stuckey tonight. Hill's been pretty good lately. He's been taking on a lot of the scoring responsibility. But, you know, David West clearly doesn't look like himself anymore. I would say that's probably mostly just that he's not playing with a lot of great players right now, so he's not really being lifted by that. But Roy Hibbert was just awful tonight. I couldn't believe how bad Roy Hibbert was. And I was doing Dan Feldman is a reporter for NBC. He and I have been just for fun because we're bored during the games a lot of the time. And pregame, we'll go make lists of all the different ranking all the players out there in the league by position. And we were doing the center. I was doing the center rankings tonight, and I had Roy Hibbert at number 20 in the league, and I couldn't believe it. But then I looked at it, and I was like, "There's no way I would take these 19 guys ahead of him, or I would take him over the 19 guys ahead of him on this list." And it's just amazing to see how Roy Hibbert's entire career has just absolutely gone down the toilet. I mean, sure, there's still plenty of time for him to get better, but tonight he only played 19 minutes. He went 3 for 9 from the field. He had 3 rebounds and 1 block. He was going up against Tyler Zeller, who was I think was a pretty good matchup for him. And Zeller absolutely humiliated him out there.
Jared, doesn't that also say something though about the return of the center? You know, everyone talks about how there are no centers in the NBA, and I kind of feel like that's a little bit of hogwash at this point. I mean, that's not a little off topic, but.
No. That was a trend that happened about, I guess, when Miami first got together. There weren't a lot of good centers in the NBA that year. And then Roy Hibbert came out and was amazing defensively. And all of a sudden, everybody wanted the center again. It's like there's no this in the league anymore. That usually lasts for about 3 years. And then new talent comes in or strategies adjust, all that kind of stuff. Like, I remember, was it like 5 years ago, everybody was saying that there were no point guards in the league now. And now every single team in the league is like an all-star caliber point guard. The first list I did was for point guards. And basically, it wasn't until we got to the mid-20s that like the guys that we were listing as far as top point guards weren't like near all-star caliber player. I mean, there's like 7 MVP candidates at the point guard position. It's the strongest position in the league now. So, you know, you kind of go through rotations. There's ebbs and flows. It's kind of a cyclical process between what position gets good, what position gets bad. I did shooting guards tonight, and there really aren't that many good shooting guards in the league. There's only about, I'd say, 3, maybe 4 all-star caliber shooting guards in the NBA right now.
Yeah, you stole my point with it being, you know, usually these things come and go in about 3-year cycles. And so I would think if that timeline holds true for the lack of talent on the wings, that has to bode well for the Celtics, who are looking to beef up in that area.
Well, they got James Young sitting deep in the wing, so we'll see what happens there.
Deep down in Portland.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the Celtics right now don't have anybody that you would project to be a top 10 player at their position, except for maybe Marcus Smart is an outside chance of getting there. I mean, I like Smart as much as the next guy, but there's so much competition, so much young competition at the point guard spot that, I mean, having a top 10 player at a position nowadays it's tough when it's a position like point guard or something like that.
Jared, let me ask you this. The Celtics' upcoming schedule includes games against the likes of Milwaukee, Toronto, Cleveland, and Detroit. They sit just a half game behind Brooklyn, who beat the Knicks tonight. Surprise, surprise. You think this team's getting into the playoffs?
Yeah, I mean, I can't believe that the Knicks made that comeback and then they blew it by letting Brooke Lopez get 2 tips to get a chance to win the game for them. But of course I expect that because it's the Knicks, right? So I got to look at the Brooklyn schedule. If you have that, that'd be helpful. But it's they're on the outside looking in right now, which is challenging for them. But they probably could get, I'd say, 3 wins at best down the stretch here. It depends who Toronto and Cleveland plays. I mean, Cleveland's pretty much locked into their spot. Toronto, I think, still has some room to fight for there. But there's a chance that Cleveland can throw in the towel against them and they might be able to pull something off. But it's not looking like a sure bet. But I'll tell you, Brooklyn, their schedule right now, Blazers, who could beat them, Hawks, who it depends. I mean, they play the Hawks twice, so we'll see what happens there. Wizards definitely could beat them. And then Milwaukee, Chicago definitely could beat them in Orlando. So there's a good chance the Nets could be losing a lot of games here and could actually kind of give the lead back to the Celtics.
And wouldn't that be nice if the Celtics can get into the postseason? Jared, one of the points I've been making and one of the benefits I feel the Celtics will have in getting into the playoffs is the fact that they'd be playing a team in Atlanta who there's a lot of things that the Hawks do successfully that the Celtics are trying to emulate. So to be able to gain that firsthand experience going up against them in the playoffs, no less, I feel would be invaluable to Boston.
Well, was it Indiana played, I want to say Miami, but it might have been Chicago in the first round 3 years ago, and they were an 8 seed, and everyone was kind of surprised that they made it there. And they played a team that you could say their style almost emulated them. Then they come back the next year. I think they got David West after the fact, I believe. And they were fantastic, and they were the top team in the conference. And getting into the playoffs, if you're a fringe playoff team with young guys, getting into the playoffs, playing a team that can really show you how it's done in the playoffs, that could be huge for you over the offseason. And I've been hearing people on talk radio talking about how there's still people wanting the Celtics to miss the playoffs because they want them in the lottery. Cleveland did get the Andrew Wiggins pick. Who knows if it was fixed or not? I obviously don't think so, but it was kind of remarkable that they won with like the 11th or 12th place in the lottery. But it's not worth the gamble to be the 12th team or even 13th team in the lottery. It's just not worth the gamble. Like it's so astronomically low, impossible for you to get a top three pick. Just go for the playoffs. It's so much more valuable to get that playoff experience, to get guys like Marcus Smart, guys like Avery Bradley, who's still developing even, all these other young guys here, to give them that playoff experience. That's what's really more vital than the off chance of winning the third pick, let's say, in the draft. That is almost no way in hell it's going to happen.
Yeah, I agree, Jared. It's funny because we were talking about this the other night, and, you know, it's funny to see the teams that are on top. You know, Atlanta and Golden State were both low playoff seeds for the last couple of years, and they, you know,
great example.
Part of it was replacing their coaches, but another part of it was, you know, simply growth, getting that playoff experience. Like, I feel a lot better about Golden State as a team that's, you know, lost in the first or second round the last couple of years than I would about that team if they were going into the playoffs fresh.
Well, I mean, if you're a good player on an 8 seed, and you get your taste of the playoffs, and you realize how hard it is to win the playoffs, that's one of the big motivators that gets you to really work on your game over the offseason. And Steph Curry went from being a great player on the cusp of greatness to being an unstoppable world beater this year. So you want to look. I mean, obviously the talent that was on Golden State is far and away beyond what the Celtics have talent-wise right now. I mean, it's not even close. But the Celtics still have good young players. They have a fantastic coach and a good system. And they have a lot of flexibility to continue to build that roster up over the next 2 years. So there's nothing but good things that could happen to the Celtics if they're able to make the playoffs.
Given the way the game is played now and how it's continuing to trend, one of the things that's made Golden State so successful is comprising a roster that's built largely on versatility and players having the length and the quickness to switch on pick and rolls without hesitating. Is that something you'd like to see the Celtics do as they build this team?
Well, the Celtics have been doing that this year. It depends on the matchup, but they have the versatility in their starting lineup to be able to do it. I mean, Brandon Bass is someone that can switch. Tyler Zeller's not quite there yet. When they bring in Olynyk, I think Olynyk, that's something that he could really learn to do. And obviously, Jarebko and Crowder can switch on to pretty much any player in the league. I mean, they're both pretty versatile defenders. So They got a lot of guys that can do that. They could try to run that system. I mean, being able to do that means you have to have guys like Klay Thompson, Harrison Barnes, Draymond Green, you know, guys that have the size, athleticism, and defensive determination to cover anybody no matter how big or how fast they are. Draymond Green being the ultimate example of that. I mean, Draymond Green is probably, I think, will win Defensive Player of the Year, mostly based on the fact that he will just, it doesn't matter who, whether it's Muggsy Bogues or George Mirison, he will switch on that pick and roll.
Yeah, I've noticed this year. It's pretty impressive to see him go from locking down a player like Chris Paul to then containing James Harden. And he's even the anchor for the Warriors' best defensive unit that's played at least 45 minutes together. So his versatility is very impressive. If you're Golden State, do you throw max money at him? Do you keep him in the fold? Or if some team, you know, if he signs an offer sheet with a team, maybe the Celtics, I'm just saying, for max money, do you let him walk?
I think Celtics, I got to go after this answer. I think the Celtics, that's probably the guy that they're most likely to give that offer sheet to, just because they think he's the guy. So, like, Kawhi Leonard, obviously he's staying in San Antonio. San Antonio will match. If someone offers him $100 million a year, San Antonio will match it. Jimmy Butler, I would say, maybe is close to Green in the maybe the team's ability to match on a max offer to him. But I'd say Jimmy Butler is probably playing closer to a max value based on how players are traditionally valued than Danny Green is. However, I would value Danny Green at the max right now. If the max is starting at 14.5, 15 million right now, I think there's no question he's worth that kind of money. So, if I'm Golden State, I'm definitely matching him. That could put them in cap hell. But they've already got, I mean, the team is already in place for them. They don't really need to add any more players. They really just need the key players at this point. And obviously, it all depends on what they do in the postseason. I mean, I really think they could win the championship. I think they're the favorite to win the title right now. And, I mean, if Danny Green and them win the title right now, it's like, obviously you do whatever you can to keep that core together. You throw all the money you can into it. And those owners seem like owners that are willing to pay that tax.
Yeah, Golden State right now is first in defensive rating, and after last night's win against the Clippers, tied for first in offensive rating. So I would have to agree that they're the favorites. Jared, we appreciate you taking the time, as always. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, guys.
All right, and Calvin, that is going to do it for us as well. Thank you to everyone at home for listening. Been real. Hopefully the Celtics can get to the playoffs. We'll find out. Stay tuned as the Celtics postgame show will have you covered after each and every game down the stretch. Thanks for listening. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
This has been the Celtics postgame show on CLNSradio.com. Thanks for listening. The Celtics might not be in action every day, but we are, so stay connected. Follow us on Twitter at CLNS Radio and check out our broadcast schedule for the best weekly sports podcasts on the web.